reasonably with their case, shed an ironic light on the idea that there had been any exceptional warmth in the greetings she had given him after their 12 years apart. They had found each other again, in London, some 3 months previously, at a dinner at the American Embassy, and when she had caught sight of him, her smile had been like a red rose pinned on her widow's mourning. He still felt the throb of surprise with which, among the stereotyped faces of the season's diners, he had come upon her unexpected face, with the dark hair banded above grave eyes, eyes in which he had recognized every little curve and shadow, as he would have recognized, after half a lifetime, the details of a room he had played in as a child. And as, in the plumed, starred crowd, she had stood out for him, slender, secluded, and different, so he had felt, the instant their glances met, that he as sharply detached himself for her. All that and more, her smile had said not merely, "I remember," but, "I remember just what you remember." Almost, indeed, as though her memory had aided his, her glance flung back on their recaptured moment its morning brightness. Certainly, when their distracted ambassadress, with the cry, "Oh, you know Mrs. Leith, that's perfect, for General Farnham has failed me," had waved them together for the march to the dining room, Darrow had felt a slight pressure of the arm on his, a pressure faintly but unmistakably emphasizing the exclamation, "Isn't it wonderful? In London? In the season? In a mob?" Little enough, on the part of most women, but it was a sign of Mrs. Leith's quality that every movement, every syllable, told with her. Even in the old days, as an intent, grave-eyed girl, she had seldom misplaced her light strokes. And Darrow, on meeting her again, had immediately felt how much finer and surer an instrument of expression she had become. Their evening together had been a long confirmation of this feeling. She had talked to him, shyly yet frankly, of what had happened to her during the years when they had so strangely failed to meet. She had told him of her marriage to Fraser Leith, and of her subsequent life in France, where her husband's mother, left a widow in his youth, had been remarried to the Marquis de Chantel, and where, partly in consequence of this second union, the son had permanently settled himself. She had spoken also with an intense eagerness of affection of her little girl Effie, who was now 9 years old, and, in a strain hardly less tender, of Owen Leith, the charming, clever young stepson whom her husband's death had left to her care. A porter, stumbling against Darrow's bags, roused him to the fact that he still obstructed the platform, inert and encumbering as his luggage. "Crossing, sir?" Was he crossing? He really didn't know. But for lack of any more compelling impulse, he followed the porter to the luggage van, singled out his property, and turned to march behind it down the gangway. As the fierce wind shouldered him, building up a crystal wall against his efforts, he felt anew the derision of his case.
"Nasty weather to cross, sir," the porter threw back at him as they beat their way down the narrow walk to the pier.
"Nasty weather indeed." But luckily, as it had turned out, there was no earthly reason why Darrow should cross. While he pushed on in the wake of his luggage, his thoughts slipped back into the old groove. He had once or twice run across the man whom Anna Summers had preferred to him, and since he had met her again he had been exercising his imagination on the picture of what her married life must have been. Her husband had struck him as a characteristic specimen of the kind of American as to whom one is not quite clear whether he lives in Europe in order to cultivate an art, or cultivates an art as a pretext for living in Europe. Mr. Leith's art was watercolor painting, but he practiced it furtively, almost clandestinely, with the disdain of a man of the world for anything bordering on the professional, while he devoted himself more openly, and with religious seriousness,